Hello, and welcome to this download from Faber & Faber. My name is George Miller, and my guest today is Sam Taylor. Sam's third novel, The Island at the End of the World, is a story of a father and his three children living alone on an island after a great flood. The father has a fierce desire to protect his children from anything from what he calls the before world, but they inevitably are growing up and away from him. The story is told in three very different voices. Pa's, which can thunder with Old Testament rage, the adolescent Alice's, shaped by her reading of Shakespeare, and the young boy Finn's, which is transcribed almost phonetically. Had it, I asked Sam, been a struggle to capture their voices on the page?
Not very much. No, I kind of knew what they would be like. I mean, certainly the boy's voice, Finn's voice, I'd had an idea for quite a long time before. With Alice's voice, again, that was kind of inspired by the second part of The Sound and the Fury by William Faulkner, which is written in a very unusual style, with kind of all his thoughts in italics and the rest of it very plainly described. And yeah, that was one of the models for that. But both those voices came quite easily. The father's voice, I originally wrote that section differently and went back and rewrote it afterwards in a fury, in a way. I wrote it very quickly, and I think that actually helped in terms of the way his voice comes across.
It's interesting you say in a fury, because one of the things that really stood out for me in the book was how well you write about anger, that sort of literal seeing red, that sort of seething rage. Tell me about that experience. How did you get yourself into the right frame of mind in order to bring that off on the page?
It wasn't difficult, actually. Maybe I've got sort of hidden reserves of anger deep down, but I do have a temper. I very rarely feel as depressed, as fearful, as furious as the father in that book feels. But I think most of my books, it's kind of tapping into emotions that you felt and then kind of just increasing the intensity of them and seeing where they go from that. It was actually, yeah, I enjoyed it. I enjoyed looking at the world from that kind of red-eyed perspective in a way, you know.
You can see the trajectory of his rage as it increases, and it seemed to me as that happened, biblical language became more pronounced, his diction kind of changed, and you got more capital letters, and it then sometimes exploded into a mixture of biblical and profanity, and that was kind of like the peak of his anger.
Yeah, I suppose it's slightly musical in a way, that it's kind of, you know, it goes towards a crescendo. Yeah, it was always, the Bible was always going to be in there, the Old Testament, and reading through that, there are some absolutely fantastic, beautiful passages in there. Some of them I used directly, some of them I kind of twisted to my own purposes. Some bits I invented, which sounded biblical, but were actually just original. But yeah, I love the language in that book. And of course, there's also a lot of Shakespeare in there as well. And the two were written not that far apart in terms of the translation, the English translation of the Bible. So yeah, it's got that kind of, I suppose, what is it, 17th century English feel to it in a way. But it's also a book set in the future. And Finn's voice is a kind of reinvented language in a way. So that was enjoyable to do as well.
And Alice's language, as you say, Shakespeare has been one of the few books that she's got on this island. She's got Shakespeare and the Bible and some fairy tales. How did you, because it's obviously quite dangerous, isn't it, for a writer to think, well, I'm going to expropriate Shakespeare and embed Shakespearean language into my text. How did you set about that? Did you immerse yourself in Shakespeare, or was it things from your own memory that were sort of coming back as you sat down and wrote?
No, I read a lot. I mean, I spent a summer reading, not the complete works, but a lot of his plays. I mean, a lot of them I'd read before, and certainly The Tempest and King Lear and various others I reread, kind of deliberately looking for quotations that would fit in with the story that I was writing. And, you know, possibly it was a dangerous thing to do. I must admit, I didn't really worry about it. I just kind of thought it would work and you know, trusted that it would. Maybe perhaps some people find that it doesn't, but I was happy with the effect of it. So
I mentioned rage was one of the things that stood out for me in the book, and one of the other things was burgeoning desire, because Alice is... She's 160 moons, which I think it makes her just about 14. Is that right, if I've done the divisions correctly?
I don't know offhand. I think she's slightly younger than that.
But so she's something like that. And part of the book is about her sexual awakening, and you use both the Shakespearean language and her more sort of everyday language. How did you think yourself into the head of a pubescent girl?
I don't know the answer to that, to be honest. I mean, there's no kind of actor-like. What do they call it? Method acting. I wasn't. There's no kind of regression into another a being or anything. I just type it or write, and I'm in the head of the person that I'm writing in. And it's true with the book I'm writing now. That, you know, there are kind of six or seven different voices, and each one's got its own diction, its own rhythms. The senses have got their own rhythms, and you know, when I write them, I hear the voice in my head, and again, it just kind of writes itself. It wasn't something that took a long time to find, I don't think.
I was sort of trying to think about what was the key to the character of Ben, the father in the book, and there's the quote that I marked down, which is, "Fear makes a person more malleable." He says that in one of his sort of reflective moments, and it seemed to me that he was using fear in order to control this little world that he'd created by sort of setting up imaginary barriers around his children.
Yes, but I mean, also Ben is extremely full of fear. I mean, I think that is the predominant emotion, even more so than anger. I think really the anger comes from the fear. The whole book is written, his parts are all written with the desperate fear of what is going to happen, which he knows almost certainly will happen. I mean, the recurring line from the Bible is, "The thing that I feared is come upon me," and it's kind of, you know, that is his obsession. So fear is his world in a way, and I yes, he knows how to use it as well, but I think it mostly consumes him, really. Mm.
Can you say a little bit about where those fears come from in his case, without giving away too much about the plot of the book?
Sure, yeah. I mean, it begins on an island, and it begins with Ben climbing to the top of a very tall tree and seeing out on the ocean a dark mark, which is another human being coming towards their island. Ben's fear is that this person is coming from what he calls the before world, which is basically the world before the flood, and which to Ben, who sees himself as a sort of second Noah, that world is contaminated, that world is Babylon. His fear is that this person will bring the lies, as he sees it, and the contamination of Babylon and infect his children.
You're based in southern France, and I wondered, because nature is very subtly evoked, and I think in this book, and I wondered if you could have written this book in London, or if there's something about living in the countryside and being surrounded by nature which somehow fed your imagination and made this book possible.
It's a good question. I don't know, to be honest, because I wrote my second book about, which was set in the city, when I was living in rural France and hadn't been back to the city in which it was set. And in a way, not being there gives you the chance to reimagine it, and it becomes, you're not describing what you're seeing in front of you, you're describing what's in your memory. And that's, for me, that worked just as well. Yeah, I mean, I think living in nature is an inspiration. I'm not sure that I needed to be there at the time that I was writing the book. I suppose one of the things that I'd noticed living in the countryside was the seasons, in which I hadn't noticed at all really growing up. I grew up in the suburbs and then moved to the city, and especially in England, I think, you know, the kind of seasons, they blur a lot, and I never really took a notice of spring at all. It just seemed to rain all the time. Yeah, spring is a sort of major event when you're living in a slightly less despicable climate, and it's surrounded by nature, and yeah, spring was how the book begins. It's Finn's sort of joy at the reawakening of spring.
And your characters are aware of nature to the extent that they portray some of their inner states by using animals, and I suppose in what might be seen as sort of primitive, animistic kind of way. So when Ben, he's got a heart condition, so when he's feeling that heart condition, he experiences like wasps in his chest. And Finn, when he's in some kind of agitated state, feels a blackbird in his chest, or if he's feeling happy, he feels a butterfly. And mm-hmm. I thought that was much more effective way of writing about nature than sort of describing things out, you know, external to them. You know, because the natural world in the book is, as I say, quite economically sketched, I think. So you can read the book and not really have a strong sense of the topography of the island. And I didn't think that mattered, because I felt the sort of the natural world had sort of kind of penetrated the essence of the characters.
Yeah, I mean, I try not to over-describe places when I write, because as a reader, I always find that if as soon as the writer starts describing, you know, this hill goes here and then below that there's another a path, and I just can't get my head around it. And the fewer descriptions there are, the more clearly I see what is being described. Whether that's what the author is trying to describe or not, I don't think it matters really. What matters is that you, as a reader, you have a clear view of it. So I tend to describe things in very simple terms, in terms of topography. With Finn and the emotions, his emotions are all animals, and that was, I think I was trying to, I tried to think about in terms of how a child describes his emotions, how a child would describe his emotions, not externally, what he would think about them internally. And you know, when you haven't got a name for guilt and love, and necessarily you don't connect the words with the emotions, what you feel is a kind of physical sensation. And yes, I think that what I tried to describe was what I feel, or what anyone feels when they get angry, or when they get excited and happy. And yeah, excitement and happiness is a butterfly in your chest, and anger is a tiger, and fear is a big black bird flapping its wings.
And the animals which you do describe in the book, I think therefore stand out in sharper relief because the description is economical. And I really liked the relationship which Finn has with his deceased cat Snowy, and also the dogs in books are fascinating. And Goldie in this book is used, you know, in sort of power play between the father and Will, the stranger who comes to the island. Can you say a bit about how you handle those, and particularly the dog, I think, because the cat, as I say, dies at the beginning of the book. But tell me about the dog.
You're right, it's a kind of a counter of, in terms of power, I think. Will, the stranger who comes to the island, again, it's probably not good to say too much about it, but he is loved by everybody on the island except the father, who worries about his influence. And one of the biggest betrayal, I think, for the father is not his children, but his dog, who sort of cowers when he goes near, and he's very happy to see Will. So yes, the dog's loyalties are one of the aspects of the power battle that goes on in the second half of the novel.
I looked at a profile of you which appeared in a Nottinghamshire newspaper, and the URL which went with it, you know, went / changed life novelist in France. And I wondered if that was kind of how you saw yourself in sort of haiku form now.
I don't think anybody ever thinks about themselves in the way that the rest of the world does, do they? But yes, I suppose so. If I had to describe my life in 5 words, those are probably more or less the words I would choose. Yes, I mean, I was a journalist for 9 years in London for The Observer, and it wasn't a job that I planned or intended to do at all. I intended to write novels in a kind of very vague and, you know, 19-year-old way when I was younger. And in my imagination, I was just going to travel around Southern Europe and bum around on beaches and write this book. And then I accidentally became a journalist. I sent off an article to a newspaper just to see if I could get it published. And they wrote back and phoned me back and asked me what I wanted to write about. So I ended up, without meaning to, becoming a music journalist and writing about other arts as well. And did it for 9 years. Had 3 children, with my wife, of course. And then at the age of 30, decided that I wanted to move away from England and to write novels, which is what I intended doing in the first place. And so, yeah, I made that move beginning of 2001, and only from that point started writing fiction full-time.
And was it terrifying the day you first sat down in your farmhouse in France and thought, okay, I'm going to be a novelist today?
Was it terrifying? Yes, because I had no idea what I was doing. I mean, my first idea for a book, I didn't even have a book idea when I moved there, which seems insane in retrospect, but my first idea for a book was to write it from the point of view of a flea, which again seems not the greatest of ideas, really. And I spent, I think, 2 months trying to write a book from the point of view of a flea before I gave up. and then had the idea for The Republic of Trees. It seemed a long time when I was doing it. It seemed to go on for about half a year, but it was actually about 2 months I spent writing scenes which never made the book because they were terrible. I mean, they had no life, and I just had no idea what I was doing. I thought because I was a journalist that I would be able to write fiction and it would be the same thing, and discovered that all the tricks that you learn as a journalist, the kind of shortcuts, all work against you when you're writing a novel. And I was certainly writing the kind of novel that I wanted to write. So yeah, I had to kind of unlearn what I'd learned and start again, really. The only thing I took from journalism that was useful for writing fiction was editing, because mm-hmm. I was a sub-editor and an editor as well as a writer. And editing your own material is a big part of it, I think.
And you obviously thought about the look of the words on the page quite seriously in this book, because the use of punctuation, the way that you render things phonetically, the way you sort of intercut thoughts from two different timelines. I mean, so you sort of, there's a sort of visual element really to the way you're presenting the story.
You're right, yeah, there is, yeah. And one of the reasons I wrote Finn's voice phonetically was I just thought it looked beautiful on the page. And the same with Alice's, the use of italics and the kind of the long paragraphs in Parr's voice, where you're shifting from between the what he's seeing and what he's thinking. And yeah, it was the first time I'd really done that, where I was kind of thinking about the page as a visual object. But you're right, that's definitely what it was.
And a big challenge to any translator in the future, presumably, to capture that Shakespearean and that biblical diction and render it in another language.
Absolutely. I mean, it was bought by the French straight away, that book, and my French editor loves it, but I've got absolutely no idea what the translator's going to do with it. I mean, I'd speak quite good French, and I would have no clue at all how to translate that. So I'd be really interested to read it.
You're a father of three children, and Ben is a father of three children. Without making sort of crass equivalencies, do you think you had to be a father in order to write this book and put yourself in the mind of someone who's got these feelings towards his children?
Absolutely. I mean, I think that was the main inspiration. Sounds the wrong word. It was the main kind of fire at the heart of the book, really. You know, if I was going to sum up the book in one or two words, I would say it was about parental love. It's about the love between the parent and the child, and the other way around as well. And I think, yeah, to write about that, you've really got to have felt it, I think. And obviously, yeah, the father has got three children, more or less very similar ages to mine, and he's living in a kind of very isolated place, which, you know, without exaggerating too much, I do live in quite an isolated place. So the parallels are definitely there. I've never gone to the extremes that Parr did. But that's true of my other books as well. You know, they're kind of what-if books, all of them, really. The other two were what-if books about my past, and this is a what-if book about my future. And I think writing it is cathartic in the sense that, you know, you would never go there, in fact. But one of the things I was feeling very much before I started writing the book was a fear and a sadness at my children losing their innocence. One of the things that I learned through writing it, one of the cathartic elements was to accept that, you know, they are going to lose their innocence. It's unavoidable, and it's good. It's a good thing to happen, even if it's sad in its own way, that it is inevitable. And you know, so I've accepted that in a way from through writing the book.
So you weren't in tone like Parr does, this is my island and these are my laws.
I do sometimes.
After a long hard day.
You know, yeah. There are rules in any family, and you know, they're mine rather than the children's. But yeah, no, I can see where that would lead. Yeah. So.